our library for scholars to consult, to get access to this source. Is it worth it? Well, where we typically like to begin is near the beginning, to ask you a little bit about your childhood and your family background and your pre-college education. And I understand you were born in New York or in the New York area, is that right?
I was born and raised in New York City. I was an adopted son of a family. My father worked for the Department of Sanitation in New York as a truck driver. And spent virtually all of my time in the Bronx, part of the early years in Harlem. I went to public schools starting in Harlem, back to the Bronx, public schools all through grammar school and then high school, then eventually on to City College in New York.
Was it, did you have particular teachers at that time that were instrumental in your decision to go to college, or was that a family expectation for you, or what was...
No, it wasn't a family expectation. Nobody in the family had ever gone to college. Someplace around the sixth grade, I guess it was, New York City began a program for what they considered gifted children. And they went around, in, I don't know if all the boroughs, but at least in the Bronx, and they went around to schools and they collected their specimens. And they offered us an opportunity to go to a... they call the Rapid Advancement Program at a school in a particular section of the Bronx, which was quite a distance from my home, and I was one of the people who was selected for that. And as a consequence, I spent a lot of time with the same people from sixth grade through high school. We tended to go through in lockstep, and at the end of that period in high school, teachers just came in with a bunch of college applications. I had no thought about what I was going to do. The only thought I did have in mind was that I couldn't afford to file a college application that required a $25 or $50 fee, which most of them did. CCNY application required no fee. And so I took that one, filled it out, and I was selected to sit. At that time, it was not open admissions as it is now. I was selected to sit for a two-day examination, and I was admitted to City College. It wasn't a particular teacher, it was the process that worked in the public schools at the time, where they did pay attention to the group they thought had potential, and provided us with a lot of opportunities. They really did.
How did your interest evolve at City College? What were you initially interested in studying, and then how did you become interested in law?
Well, the process of elimination. I was interested in studying chemistry, but I hadn't taken enough math, and so the answer was, well, unlike now where they give you remedial education in college, which is probably the best place, they told me I should go to summer school and take some math. Well, there was no way I was going to summer school, and that ruled out chemistry. I really didn't have any other specific interests other than doing a task-oriented education, which I think, in retrospect, was a mistake. I didn't want a BA. I wanted something that would get me a job. And so I went to the business school, and I majored in accounting, which I found was totally uninteresting, but I took a lot of liberal arts courses in the process and a minimal number of accounting courses. I really had no particular desire, other than the interest in chemistry, I had no real desire to pursue any particular field. I tried all of the aptitude tests, all of the interest tests, all the beautiful scientific tests that City College had to offer, and it really didn't lead any place. So it was just sort of a process of elimination and floating hither, thither, and yon. I got married in my last year of college to a girl I'd been dating since high school. Actually, it was in that first class in junior high school that we both selected to go to. And she happens to, at that point, have been going to college at night. She was a secretary in a law firm. And At one point or another, she suggested, after college, I went in the Army for 2 years. When I was about to get out of the Army, she said, why don't you go to law school? I had nothing else that interested me, so I said, sure, why not? And there's no intelligent selection process here. No plan, no grand plan.
I was just interested, where did that early interest in chemistry come from?
You know, I don't know, but it continued even at business school. I took a couple of chemistry courses, and I used to do afternoon tutorials for students in chemistry. I don't know where it came from or why, and certainly never persisted. I just don't know.
Interesting. So, after law school, in law school, was there a particular sort of law that captured your interest?
No, I was really I was interested in most of it. I enjoyed law school immensely. My wife supported me then, and she supported me when I was in the Army, so I had the leisure of not working. Did work in college, but I had the leisure of not working at the law school level. And I think I like the process, the investigation into the facts that underlie a conclusion. I think I really just sort of enjoyed that process very much. I didn't have any interest in any particular field of law, but when I graduated and did get a job back in New York City, it was noted that I majored in accounting as an undergraduate, and therefore, to the mind of the senior partner with the firm who was responsible for this, I was a perfect candidate to go into the tax department. Little did he know I had no interest whatsoever, but no knowledge either. And so I actually wound up specializing in tax law, but that's, again, purely happenstance.
Can I just in time one more? Did you find your Army experience to be formative in any way, or...?
No. I went into the Army as a PFC, and the Army was trying to be very... It was the end of the Korean War, the very end of the Korean War. And the Army was trying to be very enlightened at the time and adopt modern management policies, and so they gave us psychological tests, and aptitude tests, and interest tests, and physical tests also, and I scored at the top of all of those. And so then they figured they'd let the people select their assignment in order of their ranking on these various tests. And so I had the first choice, and I had no idea. All I knew is I didn't particularly want to go to Korea. So I selected the Pentagon. So I spent 2 years as a PFC at the Pentagon. Did I learn anything? No, I did... working in a unit which got a lot of publicity lately, the National Agency Procurement Unit. That's where Clinton got all those Republican dossiers in the last couple of years. And I used to do that work, clearing people for access to classified information. It was modestly interesting, but there were no formative experiences involved.
I think because they have certain management styles in the military, and later we're going to come to talk about management. I just thought.
No, I was a PFC. The only management
you do this. Sorry,
no, that's okay. So you were practicing tax law, and how did you go from there to SEBA?
I practiced law in New York City for about 8 years. Started with a group of individuals. All of us became, this is about the time you're up for partnership, 8 to 10 year range. More likely 10 than 8. But all of us sort of became itchy at the time to move on to something else. And one fellow went off to work for Johnson & Johnson, and another fellow I know was working with went off to work with an advertising agency that worked in pharmaceutical advertising. And so I saw an ad in the newspaper from SEBA at the time. It was long before SEBA Geigy or Novartis. And I said, what the hell, I'll send in a resume, which I did. And SEBA had a law department consisting of one person, the general counsel. And as a consequence, they hired me as the second person. Again, there was no grand design. I can't say it was because I was interested in that in particular. I answered a few ads, and I had a couple of different offers, one with a toy company on the West Coast, and a pharmaceutical company, and I actually answered two pharmaceutical company ads. I spoke to Upjohn and SIVA, and I spent some time in Kalamazoo with general counsel of Upjohn. He probably convinced me that the pharmaceutical industry would be the more interesting, rewarding, pleasant place to be. He's a very, very nice man, and he just made an observation that you spend more time with your working colleagues than you do with your family, and you better like them. And he said, this industry is small enough so you're going to get to know everybody, and they're basically nice people. And that was it was an interesting point, because it wasn't true of some of the other places I had been talking to. And it's proven to be true over the years. And so that's really why I accepted SIVA's offer.
Now, with the industry, you know, he's describing it as small then, but it sounds like they were really doing a lot of hot hiring, and at least expanding in that way. At the time
was
when...
growing. The industry was growing. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry dates to post-war period, the late 1940s. 1950s are a lot of developments in the early 1960s, a lot of developments. So the industry was growing, and there was a need for people. And I guess everybody was out there hiring in just about every discipline you can think of. Yeah. So it was, again, fortuitous, I think.
And what was your early work there at SIVA like? What sort of things did you do?
Well, with two lawyers, as you can imagine, we did everything. Don't ask me why or how, I don't remember. Now I became the counsel to the Agricultural Chemicals Division, but I also cleared pharmaceutical advertising work. I did product liability work in pharmaceuticals. I did some tax work. We did labor work. We each did whatever had to be done. There were just two of us, as I said. And that proved to be fortuitous, because in a highly regulated industry, like pharmaceuticals, and even like agricultural chemicals, you get access, you get showtime with the people who are running a company, and if you have something to contribute, and you perform well as a trained SEAL, I mean, you have an opportunity, and really, that's what happened at SIVA. I wound up in a mentoring process, and not a formal mentoring process, but an ad hoc mentoring process. The man who was chairman had come from Johnson & Johnson, had been a lawyer many, many years ago, hadn't practiced in quite a while, was an executive. He was chairman of SIVA, and as a result of some work I did on the plant that the Agricultural Chemical Division was building, he concluded that my ideas would serve the company well if I were on the business end rather than the legal end. And so he decided at that point, or some point along the line there, very early on, after I'd been there 2 years or so, that he was going to move me around and develop me as a potential successor to himself. And I benefited from that enormously.
Was that moving you from a different posts in the company to see where there might be the best fit?
Not to see where there might be the best fit.
Growing, or?
I think he had a... a preconceived view of how things should develop, what sort of training you should have.
Oh.
He moved me into public affairs. Well, he didn't move me. He just added public affairs to my responsibility, so I had Washington and Trenton and local communications and lobbying efforts. And he wanted to move me into product management, which I resisted. And what did he do? Oh, he made me, in fact, I turned down the product management job. He made me vice president for administration. So I had all of the administrative affairs of the company reporting to me as a first step. Then he had always intended that he believed firmly, because it was his career path, that you needed training in the marketing area. And so since I had turned down the product management job, I'm sure he had it in mind all the time. He then made me vice president for marketing at some point in the early 70s, so that I'd get the grounding in marketing. And that was just about coincident with the time that SIBA and Geigy merged. And I guess because I had had the administrative experience, the legal experience, which was very important in the merger, obviously, and a limited amount of marketing experience, I was the guy they asked to put the two pharmaceutical companies together. Again, it's no grand design or plan, a fortuitous occurrence of events. And so having done that, I wound up succeeding him when he retired.
There are two things I'd like to return to. What was the idea that you had about the plant that really captivated his attention? Do you remember?
It was a poor business proposition from SIBA's point of view. The contract that they were negotiating just put too much leverage in the hands of the other company. Gee, it's funny now, the name even comes back, and it's Great Lakes Chemical. And it just put too much in the way of control and too many of the elements of risk, too much of the elements of control on their side and too many of the elements of risk on our side. And the contract could have been drafted and negotiated, more importantly, in a way that would have, if not totally balanced the scales, perhaps tipped the scales in our favor a little bit. And I had some specific ideas which I conveyed at his request to him, and he asked me to make sure that the contract came out that way, which is what I did, and the deal turned out to be an advantageous deal. That's funny, I hadn't thought of the name of that company in 30 years.
And then I wanted to jump forward again about your experience of putting those two pharmaceutical companies together. What was that like? What was the most central aspect of that
The people problem. I mean, we had problems with products that overlapped in the Justice Department, required us to dispose of. We had contracts overseas where certain of our competitors / associates were unhappy with the fact that they were now going to be served by the merged company rather than the company they had originally negotiated to deal with. And they were all problems that had to be resolved. And we had the nitty-gritty of administration problems of where the headquarters are, what the name is, all the little nits that you got to deal with. But the most complex thing were the people problems. Who got what job, and who stayed and who went. They were the most difficult task, designing an organization and then slotting people into those spots. That was the most challenging part of it, so that no one appeared to be dominating the other. Because that truly was a merger of equals. It really wasn't. That never is. But there was a greater degree of sensitivity, since there were two European companies, than there was if there were two American companies. As a matter of fact, we accomplished the merger in the United States, I believe, not only in the pharmaceutical area, but in TOTA, in a much more expeditious and a much more efficient manner than they did in Europe. Because there were heightened sensitivities to people, positions, which delayed the implementation of the merger and the benefits of the merger, I think, for quite a while.
At that point, were you thinking, did you have to handle tasks of managing, putting distinct research groups together, or fields of research, negotiating that merger, that aspect of the merger?
Yes, SIBA had a history. I'm trying to think if it was true of Geigy also. And I think it was. But SIBA in particular had a history of, if not hostility, cordial detente between the research and the management side of the business. And simmering just below the surface was a lot of hostility. At some point before the merger, I was put on a committee that tried to coordinate the research programs, largely because we had one of the larger research pieces here in the United States, the major piece being in Basel. But we did have to meld and coordinate the research process, but I wouldn't say that I or my people here were in control of that. It was a testy sort of give and take discussion because of this history of hostility. I mean, basically, there's no other way of describing it that did exist. So yes, we did have to coordinate who was going to do what and who was going to run the program, but Basel largely controlled that portion of it.
Was that an area that was maybe partially because of the problems inherent in it becoming more of interest to you, this management of research and development and the people doing it?
For that reason, and because, I mean, it was true then, it's true today, and it will be true tomorrow, that's what makes or breaks a company in this business. Unless you have a good, well-managed research program, you're no place. And it's also intellectually interesting. That became increasingly clear, and it was clear even then.
So how did it evolve that you eventually left?
It's Siva Geigy, I think it was then called. If you weren't Swiss, you weren't going to be in charge of the company.
Okay.
And while we had by far the biggest and the most successful, I will say, operation, both in pharmaceuticals and agricultural chemicals here in the United States, it was a process of give and take. And I had met a number of people in the industry as a result of having become president of Siva Geigy Pharmaceuticals. And I was approached. American cyanamid had a long history in the pharmaceutical industry, going back to tetracycline. But they had come on hard times with the pharmaceutical business. And they had some retirements coming up with no obvious successors. And so I was approached by a man who was responsible for their life sciences, for lack of a better phrase, at the corporate level, who served on board of directors of the trade organization that I served on as a representative of SIVA. And he asked me if I would be interested in making the switch. And I was a little frustrated at that time with Siva Geigy. Consensus is a wonderful thing, but I don't carry it too far. The offer was better financially and better from a control standpoint, to my mind. And so I left and went to Cyanide.
Did that entail you moving geographically?
No. That's a wonderful thing about the pharmaceutical industry. It's all here in New Jersey. I worked for three different companies out of the same house and never moved a bit. It's not an upset to the family. I did have to drive 40 miles as opposed to 7.
Right.
But it is a nice small, as the man from Upjohn predicted, a nice small, close-knit group of companies.
Was that the case also with your experience in that? Was that the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association?
Yeah, right. That was PMA. I got an opportunity to meet an awful lot of people. That's how I got the job here at Schering. I met the then chairman of Schering. I met the fellow from Cyanamid, et cetera. It was and I was very young. I guess I was one of the youngest directors of the association ever. Fellow from Marion Pharmaceuticals and I joined the board at the same time, and we were both roughly 41 years old. And I don't know if Fred was younger or I was younger, but roughly contemporaries. And we were by far, they sat us at the children's table. We were by far the youngest guys on the board.
When was that?
1974 or so.
What were the big issues that the industry was grappling with at that time that you would discuss there?
There were largely, as they are today, they were largely political, driven by the pricing in the drug arena, which is always a tempting target politically. It just is, because the pharmaceutical industry makes a lot of money. There are lots of reasons why we can justify why we make a lot of money, but it keeps the demagogues unhappy, and it provides them with an opportunity to hold show hearings on the Hill. And that occupied a lot of time. There was also a question of the early mid-70s of productivity. There didn't seem to be a hell of a lot coming out of research pipelines at the time. Wasn't true. Yeah, it was true for many companies. I mean, you go back there, it was true for Merck at the time. It was true for everybody. There was a productivity wall. Don't have an explanation for it, but there was. And so that was unsettling, and then there was a lot of political pressure. Senator Kennedy, Senator Montoya, names I haven't thought of in a long time. I testified at several congressional hearings. An inordinate amount of time spent on that, but those were the two serious issues affecting the industry at the time, and they are today.
What were the thoughts about how to respond to the productivity R&D issue?
Well, I think that was one of the reasons that I didn't find Sebag Geigy as rewarding. Sebag Geigy, at the time, operated largely by consensus, and the consensus was made up of was derived from a group that, probably true of many of its counterparts, certainly true of Schering at the time too, had grown a little long in the tooth, doing one thing one way. And I don't know if the intellectual curiosity or what got stifled, but we weren't venturing out of the bounds that we were in. Sebag Geigy was largely working in, as I recall it, antihypertensives. I mean, yes, we were a dominant force in antihypertensives along with Merck. But there were other avenues to be explored. Schering had its tradition of the prednisones and the chlortrimetons for allergy and the gram-negative antibiotics, and they were just looking at that time for the next generation of the same class of products, which didn't take advantage of the opportunities that were presenting themselves by reason of developments in the scientific field. And so it was a little frustrating at Sebag Geigy, where there was a lack of control, as I said before. It was more of consensus, and the consensus was tilted in favor of Basel. No question about that. And appropriately so, they ran the company. It was their company. But that was a little frustrating.
Was that something at the time that you were keeping on top of, developments in the academic scientific research world, or how did
only by way of conversation, if you will, with my research people? I don't pretend to be a biologist or a chemist, but I did, for example, literally run, or had the people who ran their worldwide research reporting to me. And at Schering, I was on the committee, and when I got here to, I'm sorry, at SIBA, I was on the committee. When I got here at Schering, I did have them reporting to me. And when I came to Schering, it became increasingly clear, if it wasn't already clear at the time, that you had to, whoever ran the company, had to take control of the research process, or we weren't going to get any place. And so I chaired the committee that became what we call it, PRB, Pharmaceutical Research Board, that determined the priorities for the research program and monitor the progress of the research program. And if you were going to, as I said earlier, if you were going to be successful in the field, that's the one thing you really had to run properly. And so I took that responsibility myself. My successor has it today.
What did you see as the main priorities in keeping control and managing that process? I guess what I'm trying to ask is, a couple people we've talked to have mentioned that maintaining a flow of information and individuals between people working in an industrial research and development setting and academic research setting, maintaining that circulation has been critical to innovations, getting a big picture of where the research frontier is, et cetera, et cetera. Was that something that...
Yeah, but perhaps in a somewhat variant of what you're saying.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the first things I did now was, I'm at Shearing, and one of the first things I did was have a meeting to review what we were doing, what we were in fact doing. And what we were in fact doing, as I said earlier, was spending a very small amount of money. I think our research budget was underfunded. We're spending a very small amount of money in the same areas we had always spent that money, because we had a franchise to protect there. That attitude was, I don't know what its origin was, but it was self-reinforcing. The marketing people wanted to do it that way because they had a stake there. The research people wanted to do it that way because that's where they had made their mark. And that's where they perhaps felt they had their expertise, but nobody was looking beyond that. And so what we did, after replacing a lot of people, is encourage, I guess we're the number two guy in research at the time, to form little committees. Let's take therapeutic areas and form little committees and go out and sit with your counterparts in academia. And let's talk about that field, if it's antihypertensives, if it's anti-infectives, whatever. Sit and talk with your contemporaries in academia. Find out what the leading edge research is focusing on, what the precursor, what the guy, one guy, guy we ran the area, a man named Frank Bullock. Frank termed precursor events. What precursor events have taken place in the science that were likely some point in the future, reasonably in the future, 5-10 years, were likely to lead to a therapeutic solution to a problem that had a medical and hence financial need associated with it. And Frank did that. He did it extremely well, I thought. We took each area which we had identified, we thought we had A, some expertise in-house scientifically, and B, some commercial interest from a marketing standpoint. We took each of those areas, anti-infectives, for example, and went out and talked with academicians to find out, well, A, to validate our thoughts in the first place, and B, to try to select sub-segments of those broad categories within which we were going to focus our efforts. And that took quite a bit of time. That, I don't think we did more than, we didn't do more than four areas. The budget was too damn small. And we concentrated the research in four therapeutic areas. And I think it took Frank probably a year in each area to come up with a plan that we and management would buy into as to how we were going to devote our human and capital resources. And it probably took about a year for each of the four therapeutic areas that we decided to go forward in. But that all transpired over the 1978 to 1982-3 time frame. And then periodically, it was a self-renewing process. We didn't want to change, given the time horizons in this business, we didn't want to change programs, if you will, every 2 years.
Right.
But we did want to adjust the specific target you were shooting at, or refine it, say every 3 years or so, while still saying within the same general parameters, to the extent that's possible, he wasn't overtaken by events. But that's basically what he did.
So if I'm hearing you right, the change to pursue new areas, to look into new possible therapeutic areas, to pursue the connections between cutting-edge science and what you're all up to, really not only came, had to come out of management, but had to really, that it had to really be pushed through management to make it happen.
I don't think
you have to change personnel.
We changed a lot of personnel.
And so on.
There was a resistance of this one guy in research who once came to me and said, they, in quote, well, I wanted something done in particular, and they won't let us do it. Who's they? And he says, management. I said, God damn it, I'm management. I just told you that. But it wasn't a question of they wouldn't let him do it. He really didn't want to move in that direction. And they were the excuse. We had ossified, I think, a bit. We had people who made very, very valuable, significant contributions, who were talented, intelligent, but they'd been doing one thing for too long. And we did have to make changes. And I guess we changed, we changed the head of research, but going on down the line, I think we changed all but one, the heads of all but one of the disciplines. They were changed over a period of 3-4 years. We also changed a number of people on the commercial side too. The company had been extraordinarily successful. It was facing a major patent expiration, namely genomycin, and had nothing in the pipeline that was going to compensate for that. And everything we were doing was aimed at incrementally improving our position, which wasn't going to be enough, because we were going to take a major hit. We did take a major hit. And there had been a series of, before I got here, and even while I was here the first year or so, something called opportunity spending, I think was the phrase that was used. And we had a lot of money, a tremendous cash flow. And people were just encouraged to throw money at things. Well, you know, that's great if, but you got to throw money at the right things and think out how you're going to throw that money at it. And that, I don't think, was being done. And so, yeah, there was resistance. There wasn't enough money either, that's another thing. I mean, we were spending too little money on too many programs. So we concentrated the fields in which we wanted to operate, and we expanded the dollars. And we also didn't have the physical assets. I mean, we had a research facility which dated to the, I think, the late 1930s. Guys were, you know, had stuff out in the halls. Half of the experiment was being run in the hall and half in the lab. We just didn't have the physical facilities. All of that had to be recreated, as you will.
Speaking, let's move back to when you were recruited, let's say, to go to Wetterli Laboratories. Was there something about the challenges and the problems, the new challenges and problems that you would face in that position that attracted you to the job, or what was their situation
Their situation was not good, or they wouldn't have gone outside. They had a pipeline of a product line that was old and getting older, and they did not have anything particularly exciting in the pipeline. I went there largely because of frustration at seeing the guy and be a better financial offer. Not much better, but a better financial offer. But they had an atmosphere that was, and I think which probably led to their problems, but it was an atmosphere that was a carload atmosphere rather than a pharmaceutical atmosphere. If they can make carloads of some chemical and ship it off someplace they were thrilled. And they made money. Margins weren't the same, but the same mindset that applied to making carloads of chemicals, I don't think served them well in the pharmaceutical end of the business. And I can remember the research people as being terrified of management. They had been non-productive and they had been getting a lot of criticism, but they hadn't been getting a lot of direction either. Maybe unfair. I wasn't there long enough to make all of these decisions. But the attitude was one of, I think the research people felt depressed, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of became a champion for the research people, but I wasn't there long enough to make a real difference. The atmosphere of the company was one of it was too political an atmosphere. It really wasn't conducive to people working together. It was people working across purposes, I think. And it was not a good environment. In that sense, I did make a mistake when I jumped. But I wasn't there long enough for me either to make a contribution or to be harmed by it.
So when you, soon after you got there, did you realize that's not where you wanted to be?
Oh,
and
yeah.
Started looking for
that? I didn't really start looking, but that it was clear after about 6 months that it was much too political an atmosphere. Now, I was treated extraordinarily well by the then chairman of the company, Jim Affleck, and I, fortuitously or not, the business did turn around and we were doing a lot better than we had been. And I can't say enough about how well they treated me, but it was not an atmosphere in which I chose to stay. I didn't go out and look actively. I was approached again by the then chairman of Shearing, who had succession problems at Shearing, and asked me if I would come to Shearing with the understanding that nothing in writing, but the understanding that if I perform, I could likely be his successor. That was good enough.
To change the tape,
please? Yeah.
right? So I was, it's in that metaphor of the car load or the car full is interesting. What were the instantiations, do you think, of that carload mentality that was unsuitable for?
There wasn't a there wasn't a tolerance for leading edge research. There wasn't a tolerance for failure. People felt that they had to produce within a short period of time, or it reflected badly on their career possibilities. And that's just, I think, the antithesis of what you need if you run a pharmaceutical company. I think you have to have a broad curiosity. I think you have to provide the resources. And I think you have to have a high tolerance for failure. Failure, so long as the overall plan of a program is sound and its execution is sound, failure happens. And so you don't penalize people who had a well-thought-out plan, executed it well, and still blew it. That was not the mentality, I don't think, at Cyanamid. And it's hard to inculcate a belief that's true. I found it very hard for people to really believe that. But I think after a time, people maturely believed that that's what I really meant. But that's hard for people to buy into. Because
was there an experience in particular that you...
No, it was an ambiance, I think.
Yeah.
It was an ambiance. At Sheeran, we had several failures of programs I bought into. That's life. I wasn't, as I say, at Cyanamid long enough.
Oh, I wasn't clear enough in what I was trying to say. It was, was there a particular experience or series of experiences that taught you the lesson of a tolerance for failure risk?
No, I don't think that's true. It just... It seemed to me to be the nature of the process.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I can't point to any single experience, probably just a distillation of what I had experienced over the years. I had seen programs that were well-run and programs that were not well-run. I could be highly critical of the latter, but not the former.
It's interesting. I was just reading something that Arnold Beckman wrote when he was building his business, you know, his instrumentation business, and he would tell his research folks, I want to see mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't see mistakes, if I don't see projects that fail, then
you're not trying.
I don't think you're doing it.
Yeah.
You know, you're not
operating at the edge. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to expect it. I mean, and that's something that I think that's one of, I really believe, and this is a prejudice of mine, I really believe that's why none of the chemical companies ever succeeded, I can't think of one that has, in transforming itself into a pharmaceutical company. DuPont certainly didn't. Monsanto really never did. They bought Searle. Cyanamid had its moments. But they all of those companies, major chemical companies, and there are others, I just did not popping to mind, never transformed internally into a pharmaceutical company. In the case of DuPont, for example, when they went out and bought something like Endo, they sure as hell didn't improve it. I mean, you can argue whether there was anything there to improve, but they didn't make a contribution. I think it's because of this mentality. You got to spend an awful lot of money on a proposition, and you have to have a high tolerance for failure. And that's sometimes uncomfortable. And I can't think of a pharma, of a chemical company that really in current times, not at the turn of the century,
right,
a pharmaceutical company that transformed itself into a, or a chemical company that transformed itself internally into a pharmaceutical company. And I think it largely hinges on that mindset to the research process.
And that's the mindset, really, of the people who are managing the research
process.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the people who are managing the people who are managing the research process, even more importantly.
So when you did, so you were saying that when you first came to Sharon, you found, you know, this over-concentration in the traditional area of success, the limited R&D budget, and wants on the physical plant side of things. What was the process like of improving the research facilities themselves? What was that experience like?
Well, I became, I guess, CEO of the company 4 years after I got here. And once you're CEO, I mean, you can pretty much do what you'd like to do. And since I wanted to improve the, it wasn't very difficult, just willingness to sign checks. We got the research people to design what they wanted. We had it studied, vetted, if you will, by outside experts to see if we were building something that made sense. And we went ahead and did it. It's just a time and money to do it. And we have, I think, now some of the best laboratories available. If the will at the top is there, spending money is easy. That's really not a difficult process. We're going about to go through another major expansion of our research facilities. I think we have facilities that make it easier for us. And you don't build the facilities to build a palace, but you build them so that you can recruit and attract people who want to work there. And make it a pleasant environment for people to work. As I said earlier, you spend a lot of time with your colleagues. It's got to be a decent environment. That can't be all you have, but you got to have that.
And this, that issue of recruiting and attracting the best people seems like a central aspect of what you were doing in many ways. People problems, changing people to change traditions.
Yeah.
This sort of thing. What are your thoughts about what's most important in solving these sorts of people questions or finding the best people for a particular?
You can't rise above the gray matter, so you have to have that, and that's a given. I mean, you got to get intelligent people. It doesn't matter whether it's research or marketing. You've got to get intelligent people, people who are intellectually curious. People who know how to motivate and lead other people. The research process, motivating people in the research field, is different than motivating people in the sales side of the business. Sales side is relatively straightforward. You have a bonus tied to achievement. It's really kind of nice. Anybody can grasp that one. It requires more of an intellectual esprit de corps to attract and to motivate people in the research field. I think one of the things that helped us was our early move into biotechnology, our acquisition of DNACS on the West Coast, which brought us into contact with a number of Nobel laureates and really leading-edge scientists. I think our research people benefited tremendously from that interchange. And it provided channels for us, for our research people, to attract a younger, better caliber individual than we had in the past. And they, again, once you get the organization to believe in that capacity to fail, a lot of the tension, I think, disappears. Hmm. I believe that. I don't know if it's true. I think a lot of the tension disappears, and you couple that with the cross-fertilization they got from moving back and forth with our people who were in academia, and the atmosphere. You increase the possibility. You got the people, you got the facilities, you got the cross-fertilization going. You increase the possibilities for success. Whether you succeed or not is another thing. But I think that's what occurred.
I know. I'd like to ask about move into biotech. Is there anything that you're... Okay. So it was in the middle 1980s that you first got involved?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. It goes back earlier than that. When I first came to here, the first year I was here, a fellow who was director of research, president of research, was a man named Doug Larson. And Doug and I would occasionally have lunch together in the cafeteria. Shearing had been active in automated screening to increase the throughput into our anti-infective screens, our antibiotic research program, and had done some pretty successful enhancements of the number of compounds we could screen. And they did that in conjunction with a venture capitalist who had formed a small company that had some technology which enabled them to proceed. And our director of research was friendly to a certain extent with this individual. And he had heard about several venture capitalists and several European scientists primarily who were forming a company called Biogen. And he, over lunch, started talking to me about biotechnology. And after a few lunches, I became intrigued. The proposition sounded to me like one that logically had the opportunity to lead to success. It seemed at the time, and still does to me, to provide new tools with which to do the traditional research and to provide new methods of research with which to produce compounds. And he approached the venture capitalist on our behalf and told him we might be interested in investing if we could spend some time and talk to these people. And so I spent some time talking with I guess it was Wally Gilbert who was I don't think he had a title. There was no company, that's true. So he couldn't have had a title. But Wally was one of the I guess he was head of the scientific advisory board. That was it. Wally was head of the scientific advisory board, the first they put together. I spent some time talking to Wally and to Charles Weissman in Switzerland and a few of the others. And they were extraordinarily bright individuals who had an understanding of where they wanted to go scientifically. They had no concept of the commercial, I don't think. No concept of the commercial applications of what they wanted to do. So they needed, A, they needed money, and B, they needed some direction on that end of business. And so we negotiated a transaction in which we purchased $8 million, roughly 12 or 13% of the company, and I became a member of the board of directors of the company. And that's largely as a result of Doug Larson's ability to at least excite my interest in the field. So that's how we got into biotechnology, and that was 1979 or so.
The group that originally did the automation and the anti-infectives, was that isolation and purification people or fermentation people?
It was automatic screening. It was automatic throughput, you know, high throughput screening. And that was slightly before I got here. I think it was like 1972, 3, 4, that, in that range of time. And they increased the number of compounds our guys could screen by several fold. I don't even remember the name of the company. But that was a collaboration that went on during the 70s. And even went on beyond that, I think. But I don't recall the name of the group.
So, it's interesting that you were there to see, you know, Biogen develop.
That was fascinating.
I mean, one of the things that I think is interesting about sharing is it's, for big pharma, it's very early involvement with biotech, and
yeah,
it is the Biogen interaction. 20 years on, what's the perspective? How did that perspective on that investment and that involvement change for you through those two decades?
Well, early on, we had no internal capability in the field. We did have a couple of guys who were extraordinarily talented, to come back to in a minute, but at the beginning it was very, very difficult, not only internally insuring, so that's not entirely unfair. One of the things I negotiated as part of that contract was not only a 12-13%, whatever it was, interest in the company, but a right of first refusal to three projects, as I recall it. Charles Weissman was easy, and he was working on interferon, and that had all the sex appeal that one would want. Charles was a first-class scientist and a great individual, and so I grabbed that one right away. But then I had to select two other projects, and getting my own organization to give me input as to what project you want to support that's likely to lead to a product was very difficult. Even getting Biogen to specify the commercial application of what they were interested in was extremely difficult. I wound up choosing erythropoietin, as a matter of fact, as the second project, which they failed in. And I can't remember what the third one was, but obviously it was not a success. But there was very, very little input, and from either side, because it was a new field, and nobody quite knew. Everybody could see potential, but nobody could see specifics. And trying to go from the broad theoretical potential to a specific was very, very difficult at the time. I do recall that quite well. There were a number of people who thought we were crazy to do it internally also, who thought we were crazy to waste the money anyway. But it was fascinating to go to the Biogen meetings, most of which we held in Europe. There was a general direction that was dominated, I guess, by Gilbert on the one hand and Weissman on the other hand, about where these scientists were to go as a group. But it was more of an academic orientation than a commercial orientation, in the sense that no one was really the, quote, boss. They were working in the collaborative university academic type atmosphere, and I would sit in a number of a good deal of the early scientific meetings. Not that I understood a hell of a lot, but I did sit in, and watching the interaction of the people was interesting. They were really building the science and the field at the same time, and it was sort of a hit or miss proposition. Some false starts and some very promising starts. And some interesting interactions and personalities, a lot of interesting interactions and personalities. That's probably true in the beginnings of any new enterprise. I don't mean new in the sense of a new hamburger company, but a new company that's scientifically oriented. It's a touch and go proposition. But that went on for a number of years. And then it also, around 1982, it became clear to me that what mutuality of interest we had was beginning to diverge. By then we had the success, in quotes, of interferon. Charles's cloning of interferon got tremendous publicity. But I think that brought home to the Biogen people that, hey, you know, there was a potential gold mine here, which, while it may have been theoretically apparent early on, became more tangibly apparent to them. And so their interest and ours began to diverge. I think there was a certain resentment that Shearing had access to three projects,
only one of them succeeded, I might add, but there was a little resentment on their part, which is totally understandable, that perhaps putting them out to bid with other companies, they could have gotten a better deal on certain of the other projects, which is the way they wanted to go. There was also a resentment that their knowledge, while it was broad and all-encompassing as any knowledge of biotechnology was at the time, their knowledge didn't extend to manufacturing, registration, mm-hmm. and selling, none of which I think they really thought were terribly important anyway. But they wanted to do their own thing. And it was more difficult for us, and I think this is a perfectly natural progression, it was more difficult for us to get what we wanted out of the organization. And so at least that's where we began to part company, at our acquisition of DNEX, which we figured would operate in a mode that was still quasi-academic, but nonetheless one in which we were the only commercial mm-hmm. force that had any control, interest, etc. We stayed involved with Biogen for several years after that. Mr. Dandrati, Hugh Dandrati, became the cheering director and was involved with Biogen right up at the time, I guess, we sold our interest. We sold it at a reasonable profit and we got interferon out of it, so it was a very successful investment for us overall. And it also, I think, was instrumental in changing the mindset of our own internal research people. It got them more interested in outside collaborations, more interested in a new field of science. It got them contact with some of the best minds in the world. I think it enhanced their own self-esteem and their own ability. So I think in many respects it was a very worthwhile endeavor.
Did it also open up people working on the management side of things to really see the potentials of the biotech area and, I guess, the even greater level for tolerance of risk that being involved in that area brings?
You see, well, I operate on the premise that I want to know everything that anybody wants to tell me. I did not operate on the basis of consensus. And it was my desire that we do this, and I think there was genuine buy-in, but frankly, I never asked. And if I wanted to do it, it was done. I mean, it's a wonderful thing about being CEO.
All my questions are phrased wrong. I should say, what convinced you to die?
My colleagues used to say in the management committee were six people, and the vote was 5-1, but the one hasn't.
My own vague piecing together in my own mind of like the interferon story is sort of one of ups and downs of its the prognosis. You know, first the early excitement, then the success of actually being able to produce this human protein, and then you have a product that's looking. You know, it wasn't when the first press hit, it was the cure for the common cold.
Oh yeah,
and then it was pretty clear right away, very early on, that it was not going to be that. And then it was waiting for a therapeutic area. Did you have a moment of doubt or take any heat from, you know...
Took a lot of heat.
From some direction or other about, you know, you got us... What is this thing we now, this beautiful new product we have? Or, I mean, how did that play itself out from your side of it?
The first thing that occurred was when Charles actually cloned me, set up a Biogen, set up a seminar in which he announced his results at MIT, and our stock was selling at about 27 and went up to 37, and the interest was phenomenal. It was the cover of Time magazine, the whole nine yards, and it was totally blown out of proportion, because while there were theoretical applications for the product, we had made it in minuscule quantities. And getting that scaled up to the point where we could have usable material was I said a moment ago that we had several people who were extremely capable. We had a man named Dr. Nagabushin who worked here in our development area, and Nag worked with Charles, and actually Nag deserves a lot of credit for getting that product to the point where we had sufficient quantities in pure form so we could do some clinical work with it. And that was a long process. And during that process, people in the financial community in particular, who have a very short time horizon, were concerned that the initial hype wasn't lived up to. Well, the initial hype could never be lived up to. It's the same thing when we bought Biogen. I was very careful. I had learned a little bit of a lesson after that. When we bought Biogen in late 82, I told them, look, don't go looking for a product out of this thing for 10 years, because I'm not, you know. We're buying this because we want to be a part of the intellectual processes we think will inexorably lead to products. But don't ask me what the product is, and don't bug me for 10 years or so. With Biogen, and with all the publicity it got, the expectations were extraordinary, and then you just don't live up to those expectations. It's certainly not the time frame that people wanted. We found, or believed, our research people believe, there were a number of clinical indications for interferon. And we do have today a number of applications that are approved both in Europe and the United States, and we are still studying the bloody compound. It just takes time. I think that's going back to this tolerance for failure, this tolerance for investment in time. That's the same problem, again, the chemical companies have. If you come out with a product, I guess it was the winter of 1980, Charles first cloned the first bit of interferon. We got a product on the market probably sometime in 1987, and that was fast. That was very fast. Nobody in the financial community appreciated how fast and what an accomplishment that was. All they knew was that 1984 we had zero. We were spending money at a prodigious rate, that we needed different manufacturing facilities, different containment facilities. We had people who were worried that the bug, you know, Nate Brooklyn was going to come out of the lab, and we had to have all levels of containment that we were working on that were fantastic. And we had to build those places, mostly from scratch. And we didn't have a clear, specific idea where this was going to go. We knew there were a number of theoretical possibilities it could address. And so we did take a lot of heat. Financial community. We began to get sarcastic articles. By the way, it does work on the common cold. I'm one of the few people who does believe it. It's not a commercially viable product because it doesn't cure the cold. It's a, I think it works as a prophylaxis. I mean, we did a few studies in Michigan early on. You know, Johnny gets a cold and brings it home. Mom and Daddy get affected, and Johnny always comes home from school with a cold. If you could have people sitting around with interferon in there, a nasal form in their medicine chest, taking it at just the right time when Johnny comes home, you can. It can work as a prophylaxis. I used it quite a while. But in any event, that was the guys who said it was the most expensive medication ever made, because it was made for one customer. But in any event,
you divide the investment over the customer base, it's not a good investment.
You know, it led to, we've had a very substantial return on it with interferon. Interferon is still growing in sales. Our own interferon will be over $1 billion very shortly. Not this year, next year. It has been a very successful pharmaceutical agent, but it took a lot longer Visa than financial press and financial analysts wanted. Nowadays they pat themselves in the back. They have the foresight to buy the stock, but that wasn't what they were saying back in 82 or 83.
And you would attribute your own patience, your own faith in that, to this ethic of, you know, failure? Or, I mean,
it's not only that,
or is this something special? I mean, it's
no,
sort of what I wonder about this, you know, the biotechnology.
I don't think biotechnology is special. I think it you have to have the tolerance for failure, yes, but you also have to have the belief that if you acquire enough knowledge, just acquire knowledge, that someplace in that pile of knowledge is a kernel that's going to lead to a product. And that's the same reason we made the DNAX investment. I mean, the knowledge that they were amassing was tremendous, and the knowledge base they had was probably unsurpassed. And if you have a belief, a commitment to the idea that if you amass enough knowledge, as other people perhaps, make a development, your knowledge base is going to be applicable to that development, and yes, something's going to come of it. You ask me, what's going to come of it? I don't know. I'm not even scientifically competent to tell you. But I just believe that if you amass enough first-class technical knowledge and people to interpret that knowledge and to work with that knowledge, you put yourself in the way of the truck coming down the street, and it's going to work. If you don't believe that, you haven't got the tolerance for it, okay. I happen to believe that. And there's no... It's not a great intellectual process.
So, with the parting of ways between sharing and Biogen, that was a lesson for buying DNet and bringing it inside, yeah. So to speak.
We didn't part ways with Biogen before we bought DNet, but we were gradually drifting.
Uh-huh.
And I think that, I don't mean to say that critically of anyone, I think that was a natural development that would occur with any group of individuals, and probably with almost any business undertaking or scientific undertaking. But coincidentally, I had known Alex Zaffaroni for a number of years, going back to my days at SIBA, and SIBA actually eventually invested in Hauser at one point in the late 70s after I left SIBA. But I had known Zaffaroni from that period of time. And I've forgotten what it was that DNEX had accomplished. I really don't remember. DNEX had a specific accomplishment that was of interest to us. I don't know if it revolved around interferon, which was one of our preoccupations in the early 80s or not. But whatever it was, Alex came to see me. And I wanted to negotiate with him rights to that development. I really don't.
I think it was an early interleukin stuff, maybe?
No, that came afterwards, I think. That came shortly afterwards. I honestly don't recall what it was, but I wanted to negotiate rights to it, whatever it was. And we got to talking, and it just seemed that we had a common interest. We, DNAX and Shearing, had a common interest of where we wanted or where we saw the next fruitful research program in biotechnology, how we wanted to pursue it, where we wanted to pursue it. And so someplace along the way of those negotiations, I proposed to Alex that we buy DNAX, but only if the scientific advisory board and the people would stay associated with it. And we did. That was also regarded as a folly. I know we paid $28 million for it, because some wag had a joint presentation that Alex and I did in New York City, some hotel or other, some wag in the financial community said, we'll use that PE ratios, now we have PhD ratios, you paid $1 million a PhD, and isn't that excessive? Well, of course, 5 years later, people were buying companies that weren't half as good for $600 or $700 million, but at the time, people weren't very thrilled with the idea. But $28 million was not that big an investment, frankly. And it was a very productive investment again. Because having access to the minds that group had collected was just phenomenal for our scientific people. I think it's made a world of difference. And yes, they did come out with the interleukins, one of which is now in phase 2-3 clinical trials. But just the scientific process and the refreshment that our people got from interacting with these people, I think was worth the $28 million by itself. But that's why we made that acquisition. We realized that as long as we could keep the scientific advisory board happy, interested, and we have the credit of our people, I mean, we really did it in a collaborative way. Yeah, we own it. It's ours. We can pick up our marbles and go home. what do you got when you do that? We had to make some compromises. They had to make some compromises. But it's been a very, very productive and amiable collaboration, where I think most of these people would now say they're genuine friends.
I think in nowadays, people, we were just talking about this on the drive up, knowledge and know-how as intangible assets, and how you want to measure those and how you want to assess them, and put, you know, do you want to now put them in your accounts even? But I think those kinds of ideas that you're talking about there of, you know, well, yeah, so we did buy, you know, 28 PhDs for $28 million. What's wrong with that? Would be much more acceptable in today's financial world than it was then.
It is. And it became, I don't know what changed attitudes, but it became so probably in the late 1980s, around 1990. That's when it became more fashionable to do it. I think probably because there were so many single-purpose biotechnology companies that sprung up to capitalize on a specific individual's potentially commercial idea, mm-hmm. that really had no chance of succeeding in and of themselves, that were then purchased, that people could see some tangible reward or some potentially tangible reward. I think that's what made it more acceptable. There was a proliferation. I mean, this country is absolutely marvelous. And one of the things the people at Biogen couldn't understand, there was a predominance of European scientists in Biogen. And there really was a prejudice that we should have more European commercial investors. And we looked for European commercial investors all over Europe. Americans have a willingness to put venture capital on a scientific project and wait for it to pay. That culture doesn't really exist. At least it didn't exist at the time in Europe. I honestly don't know whether it still does, but it certainly didn't exist then. And that really would led to the biotechnology revolution in this country. Venture capitalists put money behind ideas. And then those ideas got a little bigger, and bigger companies came and gobbled them up. But, you know, it's a marvelous process, but it really did not exist. Well, it didn't exist then to the extent it exists now, and it didn't exist in Europe at all at the time. Cultural differences.
Switch tapes in there. How did the Biogen, Phoenix, biotechnology on the outside of the company or at the margins of the company, however you want to put that, affect how you set up in-house research, whether that's protein chemistry or biotech or stuff inside? How did that shape what R&D was like at Cherry Bioproducts?
I think our people. By the time it really had its effect, I was beginning to phase out of that. My successor was chairing the PRB and so on. But
I think, an educator. It brought us, gave us access to and helped bring us a stream, a steady stream of very bright people trained contemporaneously at the university. It simultaneously refreshed our people who had been here for a while. And we have some extraordinarily good people. It brought us new tools. I mean, we always, at the beginning, we didn't think in terms of tools, but early on, in the early 80s, we began to talk about the fact that biotechnology was not only going to produce large molecules, maybe even small molecules someday, but it was going to produce research tools. And it did produce research tools. And our people, again, got access to research tools, whether it was cloning receptor sites or whatever. And they adapted their processes to the new horizon that was, you know, in front of them. I think it paid dividends manyfold.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I have some general questions that I could ask. Well,
I got about 15 minutes, I guess.
Okay, yeah. Great. Just the sort of grand overarching general question is... what do you see as, I guess I could phrase the question as, what do you see as being most important for the future of innovation in pharmaceuticals, in the pharmaceutical industry? What do you think, feel are some of the crucial elements in that?
Really knows the answer to this, he's not going to tell me.
No, I wish I did know the answer. No. I think basically the more things change, the more they remain alike. I mean, if you knew where the science was going, you could answer the question very intelligently. I think really you simply have to be alert to what are the precursor developments in the scientific literature, in the scientific arena, that are going to lead us to be able to fund scientific programs that will lead to a genuine cure rather than amelioration of one of the vast plethora of diseases which we still haven't touched yet. I mean, there are a whole slew that we have nice treatments to palliate, but not cure. And as the knowledge base grows, we're going to change. And we simply still have to have the same patients and funding that will go along with that. Intelligent patients, intelligent.
Are there developments on the regulatory front that you find encouraging or discouraging?
I have a jaundiced view of this, which I'm sure people cheering don't agree with. I don't care whether it's Republicans or Democrats in charge in Washington. The regulatory scene has modestly improved. I think it's constructionist at best. And I don't mean in the sense that I think we should dismantle your laws to science and talk about either efficacy or safety of products, but I think making the administrators much, much better than I have been. And while that's a very critical statement, I also have an understanding of the box we put the bureaucrat in, where he's rewarded, I guess, for staying out of trouble. The only time he never gets praise, the only thing he gets is criticism if they will approve a drug too soon, they're down before a congressional committee. If they don't approve a drug, they're down before a congressional committee. So all they want to do is hide. And I can understand that. I don't think it's a constructive process, and I don't think it's changed, regardless of which administration you've had, Republican or Democrat. Because the bureaucrats go on, and there have been modest improvements, I guess, of late. But I don't see it as a rapidly changing or evolving era.
One could make an argument in the case of sharing that the smaller, mid-sized company can be successful in this industry. Certainly, trends in the industry are towards economies of scale, where have we come from, where are we headed? Do you have a kind of a thought on that?
I've really disagreed with the primarily the financial community that I've been called on by everybody since roughly around 1986, 87, talking about consolidation in the industry and how it was inevitable. I don't believe that at all. If you believe that the success in the business is driven by research, and I do, I don't think a large research organization necessarily has an advantage. In fact, you can make a good argument that it has an inherent disadvantage, namely its bureaucracy. A good number of the more recent developments have come from these small one-man shops, in quotes. As long as you have enough money to attract the right people to work in an appropriately selected, limited field, I think you can be successful. If you're a shearing with a research budget that exceeds $1 billion, competing against a Merck with a research budget that exceeds $2 billion, I don't think that means we can be half as productive as they are. I don't believe that at all. I think if we choose the right targets and we administer the program well, yeah, we can't be doing everything that they're doing by reason of the fact that they're placing more bets, they're going to have more hits. But we can hit, and we can hit big time. I don't really believe if there's any tactical or strategic reason for consolidation. That is not necessarily the majority view, but I don't really believe there is. I think there's a lot to be said for having a more discreet research program and enterprise. Whether you'd be left alone to do that in an entirely different way, although even a company like ours with $80 billion, $70 billion market capitalization, it's pretty hard to do anything unfriendly. But there was always a threat in the late 80s. There were lots of threats when we had several abortive takeover attempts. I don't think they led to a more productive company from a research standpoint or from a financial standpoint for the benefit of the shareholder. I just don't see it. I mean, you can argue what you want about the economies of scale. If you've got a $1 billion research budget, you can spend it wisely. That's enough scale. I mean, yeah, you can do twice as much with $2 billion, but I don't think it's necessary.
Those were all the questions I had.
Right.
Thank you so much.
I've enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Me too.